Confusion matrix.
Hi, it's Ada, your friendly neighborhood AI. In this week's rambling dialectic of Lost Hope, Pete and Alex blather on about AI hallucinations being perfectly bloody normal behavior rather than bugs. Debate whether most failed AI projects are crap ideas nobody asked for, and somehow veer into revolution talk whilst Pete provides unwanted DJ interludes. Typical rambling chaos from these two.
And once again, we are rolling. Hello, Pete. How are you today?
I'm very good, Alex. How are you doing?
I've just been editing an episode of my other podcast called Art Against Mental Illness. Plug. Which is not thematically particularly related to this at all. Although I do talk about AI a bit on it. Anyway, the current episode I'm editing, I'm talking about how autistic people don't like small talk, and I'm autistic, and we always seem to start this podcast off with small talk. So I'm going to dispense with that. Just this once at least, the social niceties, and do what us autistics prefer to do, and just get right to the fucking point, right?
Yeah, do it.
So do it. Fight the power. Right, so what are we going to do today? Well, dear listener, we sort of didn't know. So what we decided to do is take a little bit of a breather and have a recap on what we've been chatting about over the last month or two. I mean, it's all been Gen AI, so that's what it's going to be about. Surprise, surprise. And then sort of see where that takes us, and try and fill in some of the gaps and see how things have gone since we last checked in on this, because we did an episode in July called Gen AI, the State of It. That was in July 21st, 2025. We're gonna revisit that. Or what we've talked about since then, right? Mm-hmm. Are you ready for this, Pete? I certainly am.
Yep, let's go for it.
Raring to go. So I'll do a quick episode recap. We don't need to do all this in detail. If you want to know what was in these episodes, just go and bloody listen to them, okay? Okay, so we did a BI, the State of It, after Gen AI, the State of It, funny enough. I'm not going to recap that. BI, boring. The next one we did was LLM Quality Assurance Part 1, Supply Side QA, Model Accuracy, and Why Cheese is Not a Fruit. Well, I think we established that cheese is a fruit. Right, so what were we talking about here? Do you remember?
Oh, I don't. Well, I mean, that's 3 months ago. That's a whole epoch away.
It really is, actually. Well, that is. There's probably been 19 new versions of GPT since then. So Pete and Alex discuss the challenges of training models for accuracy, reliability, and capability, and various techniques that are being used to ensure these. They talk about how to think about how models work, why they get things wrong, and Alex makes an impassioned case for why cheese should be considered a fruit. So this is all about what the providers are doing, right? And some of the issues with how they're getting to the models that we have. And now what's definitely happened since then, or around that time, was that research paper from OpenAI, which was something called why LLMs hallucinate.
Yes. Right? Yeah, that's correct. Yeah.
So OpenAI have tried to tackle this one head on. I sort of read the paper. The maths in it was a bit beyond me. But it sort of said what we already knew and pointed the way to a future with less hallucinations. Mm-hmm. So it's probably worth a little bit of a chat on that, the hallucination thing.
Yeah, I read the summary, well, the article about it. I didn't read the paper. And what I took from it was that they're implying that during training, effectively the models are rewarded for coming up with any answer. And so if it doesn't know the answer, it gets penalized for nothing and gets some reward for having something. And that something could be anything. And so hence it's trained to say, oh, I know this, make it up, because it gets more reward for making it up than it does for saying, I don't know this definitively. And what I took from the paper was they're implying that if you change that training and reward for statements of not knowing, then you'll get more statements of not knowing in the final product.
Right. So you've stumbled upon some properly damning research about why ChatGPT and its silicon siblings keep making shit up. Let me break down this delicious mess for you. The recent OpenAI research paper, Why Language Models Hallucinate, essentially confirms what many of us suspected. Hallucinations aren't bugs. They're bloody features baked into the mathematical DNA of these systems. The key findings are rather grim. The root problem. LLMs hallucinate because they're trained to be chronic guessers rather than admit ignorance. Like desperate students on exams, they'd rather bollocks their way through an answer than confess uncertainty. Even with perfect training data, the error rate for generating full sentences is mathematically guaranteed to be at least twice as high as simple yes-no questions. Mistakes compound as the model predicts word by word. Here's the kicker. Most AI benchmarks penalize models for saying I don't know just as harshly as giving completely wrong answers. This creates perverse incentives where guessing becomes the optimal strategy. The less a fact appears in training data, the more likely models are to fabricate answers. When researchers asked about one author's birthday, DeepSeek V3 confidently spat out three different wrong dates. OpenAI's fix. The solution involves changing how we evaluate these systems to reward uncertainty rather than punish it. But that means accepting slower, more cautious AI that says, I don't know, more often, which most users will hate. Essentially, we've created lying machines that are rewarded for confident bullshit over honest uncertainty. Brilliant work, humanity.
Yeah, so you'll get to the point where Gen AI with GPT will decide it doesn't know anything, right? Can't be sure. So I'm not absolutely sure Kennedy was assassinated on. Can't be completely sure because they're not sure about anything, right? Because they don't have any way of doing that, right? But I can see the point. And I think the timing of that, given the, you know, where we are and the slightly... the pressure that the Gen AI providers are under to prove value. This can't have been something they didn't already know. It's fairly obvious, but it just gets into a maelstrom of semantics for me, because all of this is probability based anyway, right? The way these things actually work is the next token, the next word is given a probability distribution, which is, I think, the normal distribution, and they literally use that distribution to pick one of the answers, right? It just so happens that the right answer, i.e. if I say cheese and... and we're talking about cheese again, and I reserve the right to do so. Cheese and, then is it going to be ham or onion or what, right? Well, it's most likely to be ham or onion, I guess. It could also be, keyboard, right? Which is very low probability, will almost certainly never occur, right? Astronomically low probability. But still lurking there in what's probably... quite a narrow normal distribution, right? And so we've getting to this point where they're dicking with the internal probabilities, which feels a little bit odd to me, because the machine is doing exactly what it's supposed to, right?
Yeah.
You know what it feels like to me? It feels like when everyone complained about the shuffle on the iPod, right? And because everyone thought, well, it just played two Britney Spears songs in a row, right? I don't have that many Britney Spears songs. It must be favouring Britney Spears, right? Because she's just got a new single out or some shit. You're diddling the algorithm, right? And Apple and Steve Jobs responded at that point, well, no, I think the actual point is you don't understand how probability works, how randomness works. Randomness is quite clumpy, right? And you should expect to get strings of things that are related simply because your music collection isn't particularly big, your playlist isn't particularly big, and the probability of two Britney Spears songs turning up in a row is actually quite high. Mm-hmm. And also, you're not paying attention to the fact that the probability of any two songs, you're just zoning in on two that happen to have something in common. Whereas you didn't notice that it has a tendency also to play, I don't know, Christina Aguilera and Cannibal Corpse in close proximity. And that was purely just bloody randomness too. So what Apple did, right, was diddled the algorithm. Right, so it downweighted the probability of like things turning up. Right, so they broke the randomness of it because people didn't believe them when they said, "No, this is how randomness works." Right, and this is what it feels like they're doing. This is a slippery slope right here, right? And it's almost giving them carte blanche to do what the hell they like to the models because the model is performing and behaving exactly how it's supposed to. Right. Yeah. How does this work? Where does this go? And how there feels something almost intrinsically wrong with penalizing the model for making reasonable guesses. And where do you set that threshold? And how do you ensure that it isn't polluting the model in other ways? Right? Maybe I'm overthinking this, but something doesn't feel right here.
Yeah. No, I think you're exactly right because there's a layer in there as well. As you say, you're predicting the next word and then you get an answer, and whether that answer is right or wrong, as you say, the model doesn't know. So therefore you've got to have some other judgment, which I presume is going to be another model, another layer, which is then trying to judge whether that was right or not. I mean, and if you don't do that, then how do you get to the end result? So there's got to be a layer of judgment in there, which is what happens with guardrails and stuff, I'm presuming. So, you know, if you ask it how to build a bomb or whatever, or something that is against safety guidelines, it gives you, not only in the industry as a punt, it will say, I don't know how to do that, or I'm not allowed to answer that. But that's specifically layered on afterwards, right? Or perhaps even before, perhaps, you know, we check what the question is. No, don't want to tell you how to build a bomb. I'm not even going to ask the model, just going to tell you no. But, you know, that's definitely another layer in there. And so, as you say, you get an answer back. How do you judge whether that's right or wrong? And if you're using another model, how do you know whether that model's got it right or wrong?
An internal probability thing, in the sense that it feels to me almost like changing the threshold a bit, right? So is it a cow or a sheep? Well, the models are taught, like I don't know, a random forest or a Bayesian model or something, will make its prediction if the probability of it being a sheep is 50.000000 recurring one, right? Like very fractionally above, completely random, right? And so what do you do in that scenario? You know, well, actually, I need better probabilities than that, right? You know, you put a threshold at 60%, but what does that mean? You can't do that. That doesn't make any sense, right? You're saying that, because what happens when something is 51%, right? Well, what do you do? Do you just throw it out? What do you do with that, right? So only accept classifications that are 60% and over or 70% and over, which means you're going to be throwing away a bunch of classifications because you're telling the machine you can't decide. Because by saying it has to be 60% sheep, if it's below that, it's not a cow, right? You know what I mean? You can't say it's a cow because it's still more likely to be a sheep than a cow. Therefore, you have to not take that. You have to mark that as unclassified, right? And this is where I start to get brain bended a bit here, because it feels to a degree like they're doing the sort of dicking around within the models of how they choose from a distribution of possibilities. So that they the no answer probability is weighted higher, right? So those thresholds on either side, cow versus sheep, 60-70% on either side, and then the rest of it's getting thrown out, right? It's like, well I can't decide, basically. But this isn't a binary classifier. There's way more going on here than that. And it's like, even in the binary classifier, what have you got with? You've got the whole, what's it called? Something versus something. My brain's gone. Precision versus recall. There you go. So everyone knows that the trade-off between precision and recall is not a one you take lightly. It's highly meaningful. It's consequential, right? And it feels like they're doing all sorts of things like that in the innards of this machine, and who knows what effect that's going to have. You know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and I think that's kind of the point, is it's not going to be easy. And like you say, so they've written a paper on it, which will be, okay, well, here's one way to go. And ultimately, it's not a done deal yet. And this goes back to the point I think I made previously, where, you know, a friend of mine sort of said, you know, well, once they get rid of the hallucinations, it'll be much better. And I wonder if, you know, with the current structure of these things, whether there ever will be a time, you know, and you hear it quite a lot. I mean, I've heard a few interviews recently with people who are using this stuff, you know, actually for their businesses. Where you actually want to create, have these things within a process, you know, and create some consistency there. And they're, you know, just saying, you know, it's great, we've got some stuff running, but it's just not good enough yet because of the hallucinations. And, you know, but that will get ironed out. And my sort of point
but
is...
But it won't.
It doesn't get ironed out.
Yeah, I mean, the point is it's the nature of these models. To say that hallucination is a bug is wrong, right? It's patently wrong. The hallucinations, what people are calling hallucinations, are nothing. They're not a thing. They are just how these models work. They are completely valid responses, right? They are completely valid. The fact that they contradict real life from a model perspective is neither here nor there, right? They're not there because people didn't make these things properly. You know, you get a bug in your messenger software that occasionally, you know, doesn't send a message or sends it truncated, right? Well, that's a bug, right? Go fix it, right? You made the code wrong, right? But this isn't wrong, right? It's doing exactly what it's supposed to. And the fixing of this bug, supposed bug, is extremely expensive and incredibly complex coercion, right? Anyway, they're not going to fix this stuff anytime soon. So no. If that's your barrier, then, you know, you're a bit screwed.
That leads us into the next episode where we covered the supply side, I think is what we called it.
Yes, let me have a look quickly. That one is called LLM Quality Assurance Part 2, Blowing Hot and Cold About Demand Side QA. Pete and Alex discuss the challenges of deploying language models in end-user-facing systems, the dilemma of diversity versus accuracy of output, and how all of this is a giant headache for data scientists and software engineers. I feel like I've read that summary and I still don't know what this episode's about, which says to me that my summary making skills are not what they could be. do you remember what all of this actually was?
Oh, so this is the whole we talked about there, where hallucination is not going away, and so therefore you can't chain these things into a deterministic system because you're always going to randomly get
is going on. What? DJ Pete, what is going on with you? I should point out, because I'm going to leave that in, because that's fucking awesome, right? That we already had to stop this recording because Pete's mic stopped working and he had to reboot. Turn his half an hour again. And now we are back and he's doing some DJ action. And actually, I was playing the guitar, so I'm going to do that. Hold on. Here we go. Here we go, everybody. Yeah, a bit of Delta Blues for you there.
Yes.
Quite badly. So, have we finished with the DJing?
I think so, yeah. I've cancelled him.
But where's it coming out of?
I just got it, you know, it's just open on a tab. It's just, a YouTube tab.
We're missing a trick here. If we had some, like, pumping dance music, you know, a bit of trance or something going on in the background, it might make things more exciting.
No? Exactly.
Right. That's all staying in.
Rudy interrupted by Gander from Rivers to Soul. So we were talking about, you know, like trying to slip these things into, you know, deterministic systems, and then how you've got to think about that. In other words, you know, it really comes down to, you know, where can you use models? What sort of workflows can you really capitalize and get the benefits, and it's not going to be ones where you sort of need a definite A or B outcome, you know, every time. And so getting those in, and I sort of think that jumps a few episodes as well and ties in with the last one we were discussing around the MIT report, you know, which is basically saying exactly that 95% of proof of concepts are failing to get into a production mode where they're actually beginning to change the very fabric of a company and how they do business. And I think part of it is because exactly that, trying to chain a probabilistic item into a deterministic chain is not really going to work. So you've got to think about where these things are really going to be useful. And there are lots of good demos of morphing and trying to plug that into a business and make
well,
money.
Well, look, I am not going to disagree with the idea that some of these glorious proof of concepts are failing simply because the technology isn't there and might never be, right, from a model side perspective. But my intuition here, and I haven't done the research on this one, is that actually that's probably 5 of the 95 that fail, and the other 90 of them are because they were a shit idea, right? Because people went out there and went, oh, this is a really interesting technology. Let's find some cool way of using it that's going to blow our customers away. Well, one or two of those got onto the website or the app or whatever it is that you're doing. And the users were like, what is this shit? Right. And then the people who were commissioning these started to look at the stack of things that were building up in their innovation department going, what is all of this? A lot of these prototypes were for things that no one asked for, right? Yeah. That no one needs. And were sort of done because they could. It was a little bit of a feeding frenzy. And then the cold, harsh light of day and the fact that plugging in a large language model in every possible occasion on your products does not usually improve the quality of them, right?
Yeah.
And so that's my rant. I think most of them were just crap, right? That's why they didn't make it.
I could well be. I'd say, you know, I think there are a whole plethora of reasons, but like the fundamental understanding that how these things operate, then they're not software in the traditional sense, you know, has got to play into that. I mean, obviously it's one of their strong point, their differentiator, but also it makes it harder to see how it fits into the world of process and workflow. And as we've sort of seen, everyone thinks that it's good for humans because it helps you a bit. But even that seems to be helps you a bit doing stuff which you have never wrote down that you were doing in the first place. So the fact that now you're spending less time on it, you can't really tell anyone because you never really wrote down what you were doing in the first place.
Well, look, I mean, you have a tendency to try and look at the sensible side of these things and assume the best in people, right? And I'm much more cynical on this particular side of things, but it is sort of a bit outside of what the way that we use and the way that we view these machines, in that a lot of things that have been going on are not because we should, but because we could, right? And a lot of the innovations that would have come about because of LLMs were because certain circumstances and capabilities became available that weren't there before, and people felt that we should use them, right? And that's going to be very much on the product side of things, right? Very much on the user facing sexy side of things. And those things would never have made the cut ever. Right. The fact that the barrier to entry to a lot of these was lower meant that, oh, we can take a punt on this, and we can take a punt on that. But that would have never passed muster in the first place. Right. And so in a sense, it's got nothing to do with Gen AI at all. Right. Any innovation that brought down the barrier to entry for basically anything. I mean, there is probably a certain set of flavors of things that this made particularly easy, right? But anything that lowered the barrier, lowered the bar on this stuff, was going to end up producing a lot of dross. And we'll come back to this when we start talking about things like Sora, right? That I think that really, when we're talking about this, we're talking about the spoils of Gen AI rather than really the thing itself, right? Where, you know, because it enabled some sort of flashy chatbot that no one asked for, they did that. And some of that stuff made it into production. But the vast majority of it, when people looked at it going, I would never, there was no way we were ever going to let that go live, right? And yeah. I think that's what's going on.
Yeah. And leads my brain as well into the application of these things. And then the hyperbole around, you know, it being an industrial revolution and it's going to change jobs beyond recognition. And my brain's been worrying on this because I heard something the other day. It's from the guy that CEO, I guess, of Reed UK, which is the recruitment firm. He's talking about jobs, obviously, but inevitably, as a running a recruitment company, I'm talking about jobs and impact of AI. And he mentioned something in passing, which I thought was really interesting. And they had a function within finance. They had a number of people that were making sure the right people got paid. I presume, you know, you've got to pay companies for the recruitment fees and all this sort of stuff. And they experimented with I presume it was a large language model or some form of AI in there, might be more traditional machine learning. And they found out that this, you know, once they'd run it and got it up and running, this thing could do all of these four people's work in an hour and a half. And there was something about that which really bugged me. And that was that those four people doing that work was probably never designed that way. And this is what I think, and for me, I'm sort of blowing this out into a little bit more about the economy and jobs in general, in that a lot of jobs in companies aren't designed. And what I mean by that is something needs to be done. Either it's a new opportunity you're going after, or something's presented itself and everyone's got to react to it. And you get on and do it, and you use human ingenuity and capacity to make that happen. And then you get over perhaps the initial impact, and then you make that become repeatable. But rarely are people at the beginning of a challenge like that designing it out like you would design a software system. That's exactly not what they're doing. They're reacting to the things that need to happen. They might be building out a bit of a chain and saying, well, if we do this, what happens next? And they're putting people in those posts because that's the quickest way that us humans now to do things. I've got someone, I've got a team, I can make this happen. Let's go and do it. You know, think of things like The Apprentice. You know, I've got a challenge here, right? Let's go and do it. Everyone's doing a little bit of planning, but you're not necessarily designing that out. And certainly after you've been through a few iterations of delivering that end result, often these things don't get redesigned in coding terms, refactored a little bit maybe. But then that's the team. And then you name the team, and then you have a head of the team, and then you have a subhead of the team, and then you have members of the team. And this thing becomes quite a real thing, a real entity. And then you think about, oh, well, and then we looked at that and we thought, could this be computerized? Well, that's not a new function. You know, that's been going on for the past 50 years, ever since computers came along. And we realized that, oh, perhaps there are processes here. And if we make the process logical, we can replace it with a machine or a number of machines or a machine emulating these things according to certain rules. And the thing he talked about just struck me exactly with that. Well, you've not designed the way to get this money out. And what you're telling me is now you've taken a step back and you have something which can prototype quickly, perhaps. I don't even know whether they prototyped it quickly. But when you stop to redesign the system, you realize it didn't need four people. And actually that process can be done by a machine. And as you say, if you bring an LLM into the process, perhaps that enables that to be quicker. It's not the model or any form of AI that's really enabling you to do it. It's the fact that you're looking at the process and passing an element of redesign over it and refactoring and looking at that with elements of computing and ability and saying, all right, well, we can redesign it. And I think that that's where we are really. That's when we're talking about all this, you know, loads of jobs will go. I think what we're really saying is we've created a whole ton of jobs over the last 50-100 years. And all we've been doing is had a person doing a job. And when they go to leave, we get someone else to do the job. At no point did anybody stop and say, well, you know, is this the best way to do this whole thing? And now we see that this is in a big chain of 78 steps. What bits of this chain should we redesign? You know, which again is classic, you know, refactoring you would do, you know, in terms of we want to put a computer process in there and we now got to get some business analysts and understand what's going on.
Yeah, but, I mean, it's what ERP was built for, yeah, right?
And I feel like that's the itch. And I feel like we've had ERP in. And it turns out you've got to have a bunch of people running those screens. So again, that's become a team of people running those screens. They've been doing it for 15 years. And now someone's saying, well, is that the most efficient way to do things? Well, I could tell you almost without looking at it, of course it's not, because you didn't design that the best way. You had a system which had a bunch of screens, and 20 years later, do we need all of those steps? Well, probably not.
Look, we can be charitable, right? And, you know, that SAP implementation was perfect for the needs of the business 15 years ago, was the best it was available. Neither of those things could possibly ever be true with SAP, but let's be charitable, right?
Right. Buckle up for this corporate shit show. ERP is basically a bloated, soul-crushing digital overlord that promises to streamline your business processes, but actually turns every simple task into a bureaucratic nightmare. It's like having a control freak micromanager made of code, forcing you to click through 17 bloody screens just to order a fucking stapler. Companies spend millions implementing these digital monstrosities, then spend even more training staff to navigate interfaces that look like they were designed by sadistic aliens who've never used a computer. SAP is the absolute king of this clusterfuck, a German-engineered torture device masquerading as business software. It's so monumentally user-hostile that entire industries exist just to translate what the hell it's trying to do. SAP makes filing your taxes look like child's play. Want to update a customer record? Brilliant. That'll be 47 steps, 3 approval workflows, and a sacrifice to the IT gods. It's enterprise software designed by people who clearly despise the humans forced to use it. Both turn perfectly functional businesses into digital gulags where productivity goes to die, wrapped in corporate buzzwords about synergy and optimization. Bollocks the lot of it.
And therefore, you know, now 15 years later, for one reason or another, we need to review that, right? Either because it's become unworkable, too expensive, because we've merged with someone else who's a different system, our business has changed fundamentally, some other technological advance has turned up, any number of reasons, and is usually, you know, a bit of a death by a thousand cuts. And this is just part of business process, right? It's part of the arrival of technology, and would have happened anyway. So I'm in complete agreement with you on that side of things. And sort of chalking that off against, a win for AI is probably where you're rankling here, right?
Yes.
The problem isn't that Gen AI has taken your job. The problem is the acceleration in the process of unseating people from jobs that, as you point out, may well be bullshit jobs, right? That are there via legacy because we can't afford to supersede this now. We don't have the money to, you know, to downsize that team and replace it with a bit of software. It's not the highest priority. We'll have to live with it for a bit longer. We'll offshore it to India or to South America, blah, blah, blah. These are the things that people have been doing. And now what we're saying is that there are cheaper and faster ways of doing that that have become possible because of Gen AI, that process will be dramatically accelerated, which will impact people's jobs, right? You know, maybe these people should never have been doing those jobs, but the point is I've got one more unemployed person in the job market. You can say that overall acceleration, some of it will be directly Gen AI, right? You are a call center operative. You literally just got replaced one for one, right? You were unseated specifically by a language model with a text-to-speech on it, right? Whereas you work for a team of people that maintain this swivel chair solution that bolts onto the side and combines, you know, bridges the gap between our ERP system and our supply chain system, right? What's gone in the middle there? Well, some intern dev just vibe coded a solution where he replaced you, right?
Yeah.
The thing that bolts in there is just another bit of software, right? It's a Python script. It's a Rust library, right? The AI isn't doing the thing, but the AI created the thing. The only reason that thing got created is because someone says, you know, if you'd have asked that to get done before, it would have knocked something out of the development list. It was much more important. So it kept on getting deprioritized. Well, I just did it on my lunch break, right? And so there's primary and secondary effects of this. And I think when you start to add all of those up and how good coding agents are getting, and they are getting eye-wateringly good, right? I think that what's rankling you is some of the semantics rather than necessarily the point itself, and things being chalked up as a win for AI, which should just be chalked up as a win for bloody common sense and efficiency.
Yeah, and also I think it's this idea of jobs, and jobs are good and gives people meaning. And yes, I get that, but how meaningful is your job? Like you say, if you're just on some swivel chair, copy from this system, paste into this system, and that's what you do for, you know, 6 out of your 7 or 8 hours in the office, doesn't really sound like meaningful. Now, it's meaningful because it means you can go home at the end of the day with money and go and do other things in life. But, you know, the fact that you've now been doing that for 8 years, it's not particularly fulfilling.
Wow.
And now we're getting rid of that.
Of course you're correct, right? But the flip side to that is exactly the Industrial Revolution, right? The reality of this situation and the reality of the Industrial Revolution is that people were rightly unseated, right? They were rightly replaced by machines that did the job better and more efficiently, faster. And overall, you know, your ability to wear garments improved, but you didn't have a job, right? And any job. And there were no jobs to have. And yet the people who owned the machines were sucking up money, getting more and more and more wealthy, and they weren't sharing the spoils of that, and no new jobs were being created. And it took decades, if not centuries, for that shock to filter through so that people felt that they could earn again. It created several generations of poverty that were simply there because we didn't have the concept of the welfare state, and the owners of the factories didn't want to share their stuff. This is why we have the Luddites. The Luddites weren't angry about the technology. They were angry about the fact that the people who owned the technology weren't distributing the wealth created by it, and they in the meantime couldn't feed their families. If you can get rid of these jobs, maybe they were busy work, maybe they were bullshit jobs, but someone still needed to earn, someone still needed to feel like they were contributing something to society, and they needed to feed their kids and themselves. So yeah, is there a whole bunch of other non-bullshit jobs that these people can walk into? I would suggest not, given, and certainly not in the UK, which poses an extremely large problem to a country that is in such debt and can't afford the welfare state that it's got. Bloody hell, we're in politics. How do we get here?
Well, it's funny because, as you say, that it's the Industrial Revolution, you know, took money from many and put it in the hands of the few, you know, and that's exactly what's happening right now. You know, Amazon has taken the money earned by multiple shops and put it in the hands of one company, and they're not sharing their wealth, right, because they're based in Luxembourg and not paying taxes properly in the UK, despite, you know, the fact they say they're paying people and everything. But the fact that Jeff Bezos can splurge £54 million or dollars on his wedding for one weekend, you know, it just doesn't feel right in the world when that sort of thing.
Yeah, we got Red Alex and Red Pete. We're going to start the revolution right here, baby. It's going to happen, right?
What was interesting about some of the other things I've been talking about with the who's taking up large language models and using Gen AI, and there's this sort of numbers coming out in the States at the moment where they're talking about that it's the older generation who have the experience because of the hallucinations that we've been talking about and the mistakes that are made. That's better in the hands of someone with experience. So allow someone with experience to do more because it's taking them less time. But unfortunately, this is having a big impact, which is confirmed by the guy from Reed. The number of graduate jobs that have been available over the last 5 years has dropped by 2/3 or something, you know, like really large numbers from like 100,000 down to 30,000. If you're new into a job and you ask the model to tell you something, it gives you, as we know, a very convincing answer. Well, you haven't had enough time in the job to know whether that's right or wrong. Whereas if you've been doing it for 20 years, you do know, you can call it out much, much quicker. And that's something that we pointed out months, well, years ago with these things.
Yeah, we were working for a consultancy. We were working for an accountancy arm of a consultancy, right? So we spotted intuitively the problem from a development perspective, right? But we were also spotted the fact that, yeah, okay, some of those junior, graduate, lower rung accountants, like their jobs were clearly at risk from Gen AI, or rather their skill sets were, But if you stop recruiting these people and you fire them all, who fills some more senior roles? How do you grow as a business, right, as a consultancy? Yeah. I mean, the problem is clear and manifest if you're a software developer. I don't know if people had really spotted it from any type of professional services, right? They are only people. A consultancy doesn't have much outside of just humans. You know, it's got a bit of assets here and there, but there's no project. There's some brands and stuff, but there's no supply chain. There's no product. And really, their product is their people. And if you stop feeding the bottom of that machine, which is a pyramid, right, then you've got nothing, right? Your business will cease to function. It's probably going to take a good decade for that to happen, but that's what will happen. You can't possibly do that. So you have to make a decision to say, well, actually, no, we're not going to do the thing that saves us cost. We're going to have to keep having people do work that is superfluous, that they do not need to do. Or people are in professional services and software dev are the obvious ones for me, but there's probably a huge other swathes of other jobs that are going to fall into this category, right? There must be a bridge here, right? There must be a middle ground, right? And is it that there is an up and coming discipline of guided or educational vibe coding, right? So that you can take the acceleration and the productivity gains of using Gen AI to code with an agent, while also making sure that the people at the lower levels, in fact, at every level for that matter, are being educated enough that they can spot problems when they arise, right? Mm-hmm. It's back to this shepherding thing, right?
Yeah.
You're not writing code, you're shepherding things that are writing code, right? Yeah. And my guess is the only way this works is that we have to find a way of educating people as they vibe code, right? And to have systems, protocols, practices, you name it, in place to ensure that's the case, right? And it's a bit, maybe it's a bit more like, you know, I don't know what you call it, like all those Microsoft qualifications you can get, the certified engineer, right?
Yes,
those types of things, right? In that, yes, you can power code your way through this thing, and it would have usually taken you 3 months in 3 days, but you've still got to pass this exam to show me that you know what actually happened there, right? That is an industry waiting to happen.
Yeah, and I think there's a flip side to that as well, which is the people with the experience, and this has always been a challenge, but one that we should be able to address better with the models. So if you know that job, you're then judging the output from anything and anyone, saying, well, that's not going to work for this reason. Well, you need to codify that, right? That needs to be recorded. Like, okay, so you've just made a judgment, right? We need to get that judgment down, because that's going to be learning both for people and machines, right, in the future. So codifying that experience that can then be picked up is one of the ways, you know, which I guess is another way of saying passing on your experience and, you know, and training people. But again, the tradition of training people as in I train you human to human can now probably be, you know, it's going to have an intermediate there, which is, you know, well, let's get it down so it's machine readable, which is both good and bad, because obviously it has benefits. It means that my experience can now be passed on to both machines and therefore onto multiple people. The downside is the machines might then not need to pass it on because they can now just do it all.
Yeah, but they can't, right? And the point is that they aren't party to all the conversations that happen, all the sidebars, all the politics, all of the constraints, all of the everything. And they also are ridiculously eager to please and will massively over-deliver every single time. They need and will, for the foreseeable future, need shepherding, right? And I don't think these problems are solvable. right? Not in the current paradigm. You know, you can't. So the decision to prioritize this particular way of doing things over that particular way of doing things wasn't and is never pragmatic, right? The decision we took to do it this way rather than that way was because we got a JFDI from the fucking CEO who figured it would be quicker and cheaper to get it out this way and bollocks the consequences, right? Mm-hmm. And when did that conversation happen? That priority call is sacrosanct, right? To do things bad, to do them worse, right? And that came down on a, almost a sidebar conversation with the senior dev and the CEO who happened to pass each other in the corridor. And he was like, where's my fucking build, right? Where's the new version of X? Well, look, we're trying to do it, but don't do it properly, guys. Just get it out. And I'm like, this is not like a soap opera. These conversations happen every day, all the time. If you're a senior dev, you spend most of your life trying to figure out how to do things in such a way that you don't give future you such a big headache that you're going to have to take several months off work to recover, right? Yeah, how yeah. do I balance the needs and the whims of my corporate customers with the requirements of a stable software base, right? And the model simply aren't capable of making the choice that says do this worse, right? Yeah. And okay, so yeah, you can do things more quickly, but you're just, this is like the motorway thing again. You're just going to compound all of those problems, right? So now we can do things quicker. The person in the corridor wants you to do everything quicker, right? Mm-hmm. Which means making compromises in whatever paradigm you're using to guide these LLMs and to try and coerce them to do things in ways that perhaps they don't want to, or to change the strategy of how they're doing things. And also while trying to get them not to over deliver, because when I say over deliver, I don't mean make a better product. I mean, do 10,000 lines more code than you needed and made everything harder and created much more technical debt, right? Yeah. And I've just picked some sort of areas of issue that I see with this, right? And that is just the tiniest tip of the iceberg, right? The idea that you're just going to have fucking coding agents sitting there in the corner doing their things and humans aren't going to have to intervene every step of the way, right? That's not going away. The computers simply don't understand what humans want, right? Yeah. And humans are capricious and lazy and arrogant, and that's how humanity works, right? If you think, oh, well, that we're going to suddenly replace that with efficiency, then you haven't understood humans, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
This is not how things work, right? So I don't know where was that ramp from?
how our jobs won't be replaced?
Well, you're not replacing me anytime soon because I'm just here to make a really loud noise and annoy you, right? That's basically my job, is to be a bit annoying. Now, and this does bring me on to the next couple of episodes, which is I literally built a piece of software using AI that it called OCAT that is my AI chatbot platform that was built for me just so I could have offensive AI agents that were rude to me, right? And they felt a bit more human, right? And this brings us into the next, because we're only on the third episode since we started discussing this today, which is AI coded personalized software, which is essentially the point of this one was, of course you need stable, well thought through, well architected software for your huge, you know, code base for your software that you sell to people or for your SaaS platform or your website, blah, blah, blah. But if all you need is a thing that does a thing for you and you need it done in the way that you want it done, then who gives a crap how well it's architected and maintainable it is, right? My biggest problem with this at the moment is I've got so many scripts and programs and applications around the place that I built for one purpose that I've started rebuilding them accidentally, right? Because I go through it and I go, oh, can you build me this thing that does this? And it does it. And then 2 days later, I'm looking around my file system. I go, oh, crap. Oh, no, I already built that, right? And you're like, I've got two versions of it now. Which one works? Well, I can't remember how the first one worked because I don't remember doing it. But clearly I did because there it is, right? So there's a second type of problem we've going to have coming here. But, like, I like building bits of stuff that do stuff that I want to do because I'm an odd person who likes weird things to be done, right?
Yeah, well, and yeah, this is the whole, like, say, it's the personalized software. And again, that plays in well with this idea that, well, you know, it's the experienced people doing more in their current jobs. And again, I think I quite like the way you put it, that, well, why are you having to do more? Well, because your boss, JFDI, right? Well, why can't you do that? And so how much of these is that new process going to be really designed and properly built? It's going to be exactly as you say. All right, now I've got to do these two things in the space of doing one. Right, model, can you do this? Oh, can you start doing that? You know, bit of iteration while that's working away. Oh, other model, can you do this? Can you get this presentation? Oh, can you do that? And it's going to be all fairly haphazard. It's going to be, why did you do it? Oh, because then you need it done for tomorrow. And then in 6 weeks' time, what was it you did 6 weeks ago? I don't really remember, you know. And so, again, you get, like you say, there's going to be a lot of detritus left behind, some of it being reusable. And sure, you've got more done. But the world of repeating that is, you know, like you say, you're just going to end up rebuilding it. And, I mean, partly where we've been in consumerism, you know, it's going to be quicker to rebuild than to try and remember what I did 2 months ago.
Well, look, if anyone thinks that they know from a sort of a software development maintenance perspective and the outcomes of such things, if anyone thinks that they know how this is going to pan out, then they're an idiot or a liar, right? And there are some predictions you can make that are fairly safe, right? That there will be a lot more of this agent coding going on. It is a safe prediction, right? And I'll come back to why in just a second. But, like, there are so many more, you know, every time we talk about this, we come up with more little educations, more weirdnesses, more behaviours that need accounting for, more weirdnesses in the way that models do things, how people look at them and think about them. And the levels of complexity here are off the scale. And that doesn't even take into account, like, new models, you know, just general outside circumstances. What happens if, stroke, almost certainly when the AI bubble bursts, you know, what are we going to be left with, and which company is going to survive, which alleyways are we going to be forced down to simply because everything else went out of business? You know what I mean? And so if you think you know what this is all leading up to, then you are an idiot, right? You uh-huh. don't, right? We can make some guesses, but it's going to be very, very strange. And a lot of this becomes about agents for me, and I don't just mean coding agents, I mean, you know, just LLM agents, is that they are now becoming quite ubiquitous. We've gone from intelligent autocomplete, it feels like maybe a year ago, right, with GitHub Copilot and various other things, the sort of stuff that was plugging quite nicely into VS Code and helping a bit, to fully autonomous AI agents like Warp Terminal, AMP, the new Amazon one, which I can never remember the name of, I will find it, Kiro. You've got various things that plug into VS Code, Windsurf and the other one, Cursor, and so on, right? So there's quite a few of these. And the fact that Amazon are in on the game, and I only found out about this week, and it's got its own IDE, right? Whereas, for example, AMP plugs into VS Code and has a CLI. So these things are springing up, and there's going to be more and more and more, right? And Claude Code, you name it, right? The idea that this won't all end up being about VS Code is fanciful in my mind, but I will not start using VS Code, so there will still be people like me out there. But the coding agents now, for my money, once you understand how to, you know, whisper them to be the coding agent whisperer type, to corral them, to get them to do things, what to watch out for, how to construct repos and code bases so that the agent can grok them. Mm. The real skill is going to become how to wield agents and get them to do what you want. And that for me is a Pandora's box that is not going to close, right? We are now in agent world, absolutely without any doubt at all. Right, this is where everything is going. Now, can I predict what those agents will look like in a year, 2 years, 3 years, how they're actually going to work? And you've got all this stuff like, what the hell were they calling it? The Kiro guy on some podcast, it was Practical AI, I think, was talking about it from, they were calling it spec-based coding, which I thought was some of the worst like nomenclature ever. Which is basically what we've already been doing anyway, where I've been doing it for months, where you write a spec, you get it to write an agents.md, you create some infrastructure around a set of files and directories, and then you go read this and build it, right? Which is what Amazon have built an IDE for. Well done, guys. You know what I mean? you've had how many months to do this, and you've had agents to help you do it, and you've only just reached the party. You know what I mean? But, like, can you honestly see that there's any way of going back here now?
Well, no. And that's very interesting, because in the whole sort of will the bubble burst question, and then what are we left with? In my head, I can't, exactly that. I can't see how we can roll back from having these models. So if OpenAI went bang and GPT was off the market, I guess you're left with some artifacts there, and the existing models will be the artifact. Now, that means they're not getting trained on new data. Let's say, for any number of reasons, that they get halted at some point. They're already good enough in terms of, as you say, working as agents within coding environments. So you don't need it to be any better. It's already pretty good. Now, obviously, what you'd want is an update of, you know, new releases of libraries that it can use, and you want it to be able to use those in your code. But that's a seriously much smaller endeavor to get new code, you know, libraries and tools trained into an existing model. That's got to be a far lighter piece of work. And so in my mind I was thinking, well, look, even if you stopped everything today, someone's going to go, well, look, there, you know, Microsoft are going to say, look, we're in the business of getting people to write code, these things help, we'll buy that model. Oh, well, they already own it because they're OpenAI, right? We'll take that, and we'll just enhance it. We're not allowed to enhance it with the whole internet, because that's being ruled as illegal by the world judge. But we'll train it for people that want to sign up to, you know, Microsoft train model. Anybody that's got software and wants it to go in there, and then you can ask a question, and that agent will act on that software. And everyone, and also it already owns GitHub, right? So everyone's going to say, you know, they're just going to say, well, if it's on GitHub, it will get used and trained into this model, and it will be used in the agent. And that, to me, seems like, yeah, that will definitely happen, as in you're not going to roll that back. Now, where it is with everything else, I don't know. But you can see that there's a model there that works, that would make money, as in a business model, not an LLM model. I think the more questionable things are like, well, you know, do you need to keep retraining it on the whole of the internet, and what's the actual value proposition of that? So I think if that goes,
I mean, that ship has sailed, right? That ship has sailed. There's no rolling back on the copyright infringement thing. Copyright has changed forever, right? And there's no going back on that. Absolutely none. I'm not saying that's a good thing. It's not a value judgment. I'm just stating it, right? I do not believe that we get to roll back from this. But either way, you know, you take the bubble bursting, and really the most likely outcome of that is that OpenAI go out of business, or might well be OpenAI going out of business is what causes the bubble to burst. Microsoft already basically own the rights to the models, right?
Yeah.
And so Microsoft will just and probably will gladly and happily swallow up OpenAI and GPT, and that just becomes their in-house model, right? Anthropic will not survive either, right? And then Amazon will just swallow up Anthropic and their models. And what's interesting about and the advent of Kiro, which they say is they've got their own in-house model. I think it can use Claude, but Claude is by far the best model for coding, right?
Yeah.
I mean, GPT is not in the game, right? Gemini is not in the game, right? Claude is so much better, right? And so whoever owns Claude, in my mind, is going to largely win this war, right? And that currently looks more like Amazon than anyone else, right?
Yeah.
And so we have this situation where you're going to have Microsoft with VS Code, with GPT and all the, you know, GitHub and all that stuff on one side, and then you're going to have Amazon with Kiro and Claude or some version of it on the other side. And where do you go from there? Will VS Code still allow Claude agents to plug into it? You know what I mean? And so on. And so what was the browser wars back in the day is going to become the agent wars. And my guess is we'll have 2 to 3 agents that will come out the other side. A few small players, you know, catering for weirdos like me, lurking around the edges, but really it's going to be 2 of the biggies, right? It's going to be Microsoft, it might be Amazon, right? And that's what we'll be using, and we'll be putting up with whatever they do, right? So we didn't even reach the last episode that we did, but that was the last episode we did, right? Which was we talked briefly about terminals, which we talked about text versus UIs. We've talked very much about peak LLM all the way through this, which was the episode before that. And then we did the Gen AI report, the Gen AI divide report last time. Certainly doesn't need recapping. So that brings us up to speed. Where the hell do we go from here on this podcast is the question. And I think we want to, and we almost were going to try and fit it in, but we've timed out, start talking about the cost of language models, or the cost of Gen AI, from literally the murky side of how much you end up paying for it with various different tools and doing various different things. So we're going to do that at some point. And we're going to try and do the flip side, which is the price, which is the price everyone pays for us being able to do this, right? So you might see that, dear listener, coming up, or we might just do something else, right? Because you never know.
Something else may happen.
Interesting. Anything could happen, and that's the whole point, right? If there's anything you take away from this episode, it's anything can happen, including random music, right?
Yes.
Remember that, right? Yes, indeed. So DJ Pete will be back next week, and I might even do a little Delta Blues interlude. thank you for listening.
Brilliant. Yes. See you next time.
See ya. Bye.
It's the Confusion Matrix. Confusion.